What is up? It is me, George G. We've got another awesome episode of the Aligned Money Show coming your way featuring Jamie Hopkins. Jamie is the Chief Executive Officer at Bryn Mawr Trust. He is the founder and president of the FinServe Foundation. He's also an author many times over. His newest book is Your Retirement Sketchbook. We had a great conversation that, of course, started with two truths and a lie. And then we got into how to make financial education and the adoption of financial ideas. How do we make it easier for people to move from financial literacy to financial wellness? And talked about how using digestible bites, taking small bites of big topics and big concepts is a great way to do it. We talked about using visuals and actually drawing and how that can help people to take more positive financial action. We talked about the value of mentorship. We had a great difference-making tip. I know you're going to love it. Let's go. Jamie, to get us started, give me two truths and a lie, please.
Yeah. So let's see. One time I beat Michael Phelps in a swimming race.
Oh, nice. Before
I entered finance, I had a brief career as a chef. And I'm the oldest of five siblings with four sisters.
Wow. One, extremely improbable. Two, very believable.
Yeah.
Is Jamie Hopkins a swimmer? Or maybe he's way older than Michael Phelps, and Michael Phelps was like a baby. Let's see here. Oldest of five, he said?
Yep.
With four sisters. Professional chef early on before getting into finance. Wow. Okay. Let's see here. I am going to say, just because it's so improbable, that there's no way that you are the oldest of five.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. I like how you went with that one. I feel like that. I totally am the oldest of five. I do. It seems really improbable, almost unbelievable.
Tell me about Michael Phelps.
I grew up swimming with Michael Phelps, and for a brief period of time, I could beat him in breaststroke for a couple years. But we're actually a month apart in age, and we swam together for about 12 years. I'm not saying I'm better than Michael Phelps, just for like the whole record of this, that nobody's like, hey, this dude came on here. Like,
right.
Yeah, that, we're talking about like 12-year-old Jamie Hopkins beating him in one event. You know, that's it.
I'd get a tattoo of that, though.
Yeah, he's the greatest Olympic athlete of all time, and I'm super proud of him, and no, I was not faster than him, but yes, for brief periods of time he was bad at breaststroke, got better at it.
Okay, good enough. So do you know how to cook things,
Jamie? I do, yeah, but I've never been a chef. I do love cooking, but one of my goals is actually to buy a food truck here in the next, I'll say, 3 to 5 years, for fun, not for my job. And that seems weird to probably people who run food trucks because it's a hard living. But I would love to do it at like festivals and kids' sporting events and just do it on weekends. And if it's not how I'm trying to make a living, I think I could enjoy it.
And what kind of food will be serving out of this truck?
There's actually a whole plan. So it's actually going to be called Bumpy's Burgers. It's a dinosaur is the drawing. I actually have all the art for the side of the thing already created. But it's Bumpy the dinosaur, and it's Bumpy because you're driving around a food truck. So he's like got a chef hat. He's holding these burgers that are flying in the air. But yeah, I'm a big burger person. So, burger, fried chicken, type of food truck. And tater tots, not fries. That's an interesting decision, but I've decided that I landed on that one. So that will be the future Bumpy's Burgers.
I love everything about that. Well, this was an excellent, excellent two truths and a lie. You got me. Congratulations. I like it. All right. Well, moving on from your exceptional career as an athlete, your aspirations as a food truck owner, and just happened to be born first. What is top of mind for you right now?
Yeah. Well, probably my favorite thing in life right now is actually coaching and in a couple different arenas. So I think you know we've talked about it before, but I helped found a nonprofit about 7, 8 years ago now. I guess we're coming up on year 8. And so I coach and mentor young professionals coming into financial services there in FinServ Foundation. It's one of the things I love the most in life. I mean, I probably spend about 2 hours a day working with young professionals, which is a lot.
Wow.
But it is my passion to give back. And if I don't do it, nobody's going to do it. That's how I viewed, starting it. And I coach, 8-year-old basketball team too. So that's always, they're a little different. I'm mostly just babysitting and yelling the entire time there. But it's great to see, young kids and how much better they get so quickly. Like you think about that first practice 3 months ago and where they are 3 months later, it's just amazing to see development like that. And it's inspiring to me.
Well, kudos to you because your time is immensely valuable, but recognizing that if I don't do it, then is it going to get done? So that's really cool and certainly appreciate the commitment and the effort that it takes to run a kids' sports team. So I think that that's awesome. Right on. Well, talking about learning and upping your skill set, I think sometimes when we try to picture our entire financial lives all at once, just like the Stoics say, don't try to imagine your life all at once. We have to take small bites.
It's totally true. And, I know I'll mention a little bit, but I wrote a new book here called Your Retirement Sketchbook. And that was the whole approach. And the people have asked me, like, well, why did you do this one? And it's a little funny because authors give 1,000 different reasons. And mine was actually that I had a creative thought in my head that I really believe would help people approach retirement in a more of a piecemeal and visual way. Almost everything in the financial services space is graphics and numbers and written content, and we don't give a lot of like visualization of things. So I wanted to take what I thought was a giant concept of retirement, which is everything all at once for 40 years, and break it down into really bite-sized pieces. So 125 distinct retirement topics, and then have pictures and artwork that went along with every single one. Most people are visual learners, and most of our content in this space is not very visual. So, that part of like development and helping people learn, is really the inspiration behind this work.
Well, I certainly echo that. How did you get to 125? Did you boil it down from 10,000 or did you work up from 60?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting thing. And I'll give this advice because there's a lot of different ways to write books out there, and it's going to change with AI too. But I've written now, this is actually my ninth book of some sort, and but really my third, general consumer book. I've done a couple textbooks and ebooks, but I wrote most of this book in an Excel file, as weird as that sounds. I kind of created a format and a structure I liked for the topics. I did end up with more than 125, George. I actually had about 160. And then I started saying, like, are some of these really important enough? Are they too nuanced, right? And I tried to whittle out the more esoteric, like, ivory tower-esque feeling topics that apply to, a half of 1% of people. Although maybe in the advice world, we like talking about them. They're just not needle movers for most Americans. So kind of whittled it down, felt like 125 was a number that I could live with and probably book length then too.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I've never thought to write using an Excel document, but it's almost like you're creating the chapters or the pages, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, so every chapter was a line. Right. So chapter one, I put the title and then I put what I wanted to accomplish in it. I went and got a statistic that related to that topic. I wrote a quote for it, an explanation and reflection questions. Now, the book is not written like that, but I had everything I needed for that chapter in a line. And then we kind of put it together to create an actual readable chapter. So it doesn't read like an Excel sheet. If you read it, you'd be like, how was this written in an Excel document? But I found every element I wanted to put into every chapter and built that out. So it was very interesting because it also allowed me to like jump around. Like I could go work on chapter 42 on three elements of it without really having to be like reconfigure myself to what is chapter 43 or topic 43.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Is it just how did you decide number one versus number 125?
Yeah, so that one actually makes a lot more logical sense maybe to most people. So the idea is we're supposed to take you through this journey of retirement. So actually chapter one starts with like, really, what is that first money memory you have? Like, what is that experience that shaped your foundations, your relationship with money? And then we go through some of those behavioral, you know, biases or conflicts or hurdles you might have with money. And that's really how the book starts. It's like, let's just understand where you are with money. Like, how do you feel about it? Like, do you come from scarcity or abundance background? And then we went into like saving for retirement, then investing for retirement, then preparing for retirement, then distributing, then living in retirement, and then like down all the way to estate planning and legacy. And what are you leaving behind as an impact on the world? So it kind of goes through the phases. And our, and making it so modular then too was like, if you're already, you know, I had this problem when I wrote my first book, was it was really all like retirement income planning. So there was only like people in a 10-year window that like it was relevant to. But if you pick up this book and you're 45, there's a bunch of stuff that's relevant for you. Now, the back three chapters aren't, but those are relevant to a completely different person. So you can kind of piecemeal and look at a couple things. I don't think you have to read this book front to back, although some people might. You know, I think for a lot of people, you can kind of pick and choose the stuff that you want to engage with.
And that's a good term for it, right? Is how to engage with some of these ideas, because I imagine while it's an obvious thing, think back to your earliest money memory, I don't think that anybody's really like, why would I do that unless I was prompted, right?
Yeah, you don't just like wake up on Tuesday and be like, I'm going to go think about that, right? Like, but it's a fun exercise. I actually think most people enjoy it. It's not the scary one. Like, there's scarier stuff people don't want to go through. Like, you talk about like planning for your estate and writing your obituary type lessons. No, not everybody loves that. Just like, but like, what was your first money memory? You're like, oh yeah. Like, even if it was a tough money memory, there's probably some element of it that, you know, is inspiring or driving for you. So like, I tell my own story in the book again, too. Like, my dad passed away when I was 8 years old in a construction accident, right? And I went through as an 8 year old that scarcity of losing your father. Him and my mom ran the construction business together. He did the construction work. So as an 8 year old, I don't know much about business, right? But I do know that like somebody goes out and does the work on a construction site. Like, that is how you get paid. And without him, that's a bad thing. And so that whole scarcity around the loss of my dad and the risk to this business, all those things occurred. And like, that's my first money experience. So how do then I relate to money over the course of my life with this being really the first monumental thing that comes in? A funny part about that too is my mom and I have never really talked about that till like 5 years ago. And it's interesting how different her view on it is than me, right? We went through the same event, but with vastly different experiences, because she was an entrepreneur who started a business with her husband. And her view was, I will figure this out. Like, we figured out how to do it originally. I will figure out it again. She is 70 years old and still runs that company today. Like, amazing, right? Yeah. but 8 year olds, I didn't have any experiences. I wasn't an entrepreneur or anything, right? I'm just a little boy who is lost at that moment.
Yeah. How are you hoping that people are going to consume this? I'm sure some people are just going to do it on their own, but do you see people having like a conversation with the family about it?
Yeah. So different elements. Yes. We actually do a lot in the book. My co-author Bonnie Treichel and I do talk about engaging families, like talk and techniques you can even do with your kids. So I'll give one good example of that is on the charitable side, because it's something I do in my own life. Best examples are those ones, not the ones I say, you know, do as I say, not as I do. But I say get kids involved with those charitable decisions in your family. It doesn't matter how small it is. But instead of giving our cousins gifts, we talked about this a couple years ago, was like, we're going to donate on their behalf. So like the cousins of my kids, we don't give them Christmas or holiday gifts or whatever other gifts they might. We donate something on their behalf. And actually some of our family has started doing the same, but we let our kids pick those. So like my daughter picked St. Jude's Hospital. We gave her a list of things and explained it to her. And she's like, let's donate there. So every time she sees like an ad for it or something, she's like, oh, we donated to help the kids with cancer too. And it's gotten her this whole notion of like give back. And I was super proud of her. So she's 9 years old, but a couple of weeks ago they had off on a Monday and she actually came and said, hey, can we go give back at a hospital or a food, like a food bank or something? And I was just like, this is what you want to do on your day off? And she was like, yes. And so we went and did that. But that was, you know, a financial instillment of involving the family. But it came from a notion of like align your own values and your money together and then pass that on to the next generation.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing. As a, I don't know what the term is, that what emotion washed over you when your daughter said that she wanted to go do that on a Saturday. But pride is absolutely one of those things of, oh, it's actually working. I'm instilling these wonderful qualities in my children.
Yeah. And I mean, those things have to be purposeful. And I think that's a good lesson around money, too. I mean, you brought it up, like unless you're purposeful or prompted on a lot of these topics, you won't do them. They're not natural. It's not like I get tired and I go to sleep at night. You don't like get excited about reviewing the history of money in your family and then do that, right? Like they're different. So they have to be prompted. They have to be purposeful. You've got to kind of know about the things you don't know about to explore them.
So you've now written textbooks. You've written about rewiring your brain with money. And now this book with the pictures in it. I mean, the whole trick is taking complicated things and making them easy to understand, and then how to actually help people take action on it so they do the stuff. Did you know that you wanted to incorporate images and pictures, or was that kind of along the way?
No, I did. So the whole book on this one was written because I did want to figure out a way to take all these pictures and like make it relatable to people. And you know, look, I think we did a good job. It'll be proven out if people actually like it and enjoy it and relate to it. I mentioned that word engagement before, but to me, visualizations of concepts are more engaging. And so the whole notion was like people read books and there's a handful of financial planning books out there that have been really successful. But I really do say like a handful. There's a lot of somewhat successful books, but most of them are academically driven people. I mean, Morgan Housel and Daniel Crosby, I love both of those guys. They're very academically driven, you know, approaches to the world when we look at finance. And, you know, I think what's important though is like there's a whole other world, which is probably more along the lines of, you know, Rich Dad, Poor Dad, which related very well to mass America, but was honestly less academically driven work, but very relatable. People gravitated towards it. They could understand the concepts. And my hope is it kind of falls somewhere in between there that makes this concept more fun. I've said that a lot too, which is a funny term when you talk about retirement, like planning books is like, I wanted your retirement sketchbook to be the enemy of a boring retirement plan. Like fun drawings, draw stuff, sketch things out, like engage with the artist, all those types of things should be really different. This shouldn't always have to be scary and Excel driven conversations.
I remember having fun when I was a kid, so why can't we map that onto money as an adult?
Yeah, well, that's there's a lot of research out there on that too, right? That we kind of lose the ability to have fun, right? And have free time fun too, like non-structured fun. We get really bad at when we get to be adults, right? Like, you know, we're kids, just like you have recess and you go play and you find a stick and a rock and you create a game out of it and you chase people. And we struggle with that, right? Like, so I think this whole idea, and that was the sketch part too, like, why isn't it retirement blueprint or retirement painting, was like, it should be like, you should be able to like erase it and redo it and like draw a little circle over here and then like, oh, I don't like that, sketch it back out. And that was very purposeful on that wording too, because it should be kind of free floating and adaptable and fun.
Yeah. I'm not aware of the research about growing ups having a hard time having a good time, but I'm anecdotally certainly aware of that phenomenon. And so I think
you're like, I can see that in real life.
I can't prove why that is. I just know that it is. So, you know, Jamie, I remember a time when you had long hair and you were just footloose and fancy free, buddy. And now you've got this short haircut. You're all buttoned up. You're a CEO now.
I'm in a suit every day. And yeah, I do miss my long hair from time to time. It's how long's your hair right now? It looks pretty long there.
It's very long.
Yeah, it's looking good. I do miss it some days. I tell people were a lot nicer to me when I had the long hair. I don't know if you feel that way too, but like people just like talk about fun things that nobody talks to me about. You know, they don't want to talk about fun things when I'm walking around in a suit, right?
Was this guy an accountant?
Yeah, accountant. I'm a tax attorney. I run a financial firm, you know, CEO of Brimar Trust. Like none of that.
Like, no, I've got this burger truck. Then I swear to God, yeah. I beat Michael Phelps in swimming.
Yeah.
For God's sakes.
And I've got Bumpy's Burgers. Like that dude has long hair. He's a blast.
Yeah. I'm the same guy.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you probably didn't hear that story, although I've weaved a lot of charitable philanthropy stuff into this. It's not my entire life, but it feels like it when I talk about it, I guess. But I actually, one of my sisters, who we talked about earlier, had aplastic anemia and went through chemo and, you know, had a wig, all of those things. And during the pandemic, I let my hair grow out super long, loved it. I did have that long hair earlier in life when I was in a band, wasn't one of my fun facts today, but I regrew it out. But then I decided to, you know, grow it out long enough for Wigs for Kids and donate it and raise some money too. So I think it was it's bad that I can't remember. We were either $24,000 or $26,000 I raised to cut my hair, and I did it live. We actually live stream it back then on Twitter, now X.
Awesome.
And cut it all off live and donated the money also to Wigs for Kids and the hair. So it was, you know, while it was sad to see it go, it was for a good reason.
Yeah, I think that's super cool. All right, I've got a couple more questions for you. Which of the 125 do you think that is maybe the heaviest or one of the most challenging?
Yeah, I mean, we do talk about the, you know, the act of writing your own obituary in towards the end of the book. I think that's one of the heaviest things you can do. And if you've never written something like that, there's different variations of it. You can write a legacy letter too, which is a really cool thing, which is like talking to your kids and your loved ones about like what you love about them and the impact you'd love to see from them. Interestingly enough, I've gotten to meet Sir Richard Branson a couple times through an entrepreneur group that I'm part of. And he's written it like three times when he thought he was going to die. He wrote one on the inside of a capsule when he was flying across the Atlantic and it was crashed. And he thought he was dying, and he wrote a goodbye thing like literally on the wall of this hot air balloon as it was going down in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. And like you go through some of those things, you're like, wow, like you don't have to wait until your hot air balloon is crashing in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean to write this. And I have another friend who that's what he does as a profession now. And his story is wild. His dad passed away actually on a family vacation while he was there. And the letter was in his dad's, like, you know, materials, and he got it like right after. But he had not written it because he knew he was going to pass away. He just happened to have already done it. Oh. So I think those things are really powerful and meaningful. And again, unless somebody prompts you and tells you about this, you don't wake up on Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday and Saturday before a kid's basketball game and be like, I should write a letter in case something happens to me. It appeals to me a lot because I lived through that. Like I saw the experience of right, my dad being there in the morning, and I remember being in the kitchen saying goodbye. And I remember coming home from school and not having a dad anymore. You know, not everybody, and it's a good thing that most people don't have those abrupt experiences, but they do happen. And so preparing for those, I think, is super important for your spouse in retirement, for your kids, your grandkids. And that's a heavy topic to work through.
Yeah. But to your point, so incredibly valuable. It's like, yeah, we all know that we should have goals, but only 3% of us write them down. But once you do it, once you think about your personal values, then you have them for the rest of your life and sit down and think about what you want to have as a legacy or what you want your kids to know, whatever it might be. It's such a wonderful exercise. So that's a great tip, Jamie, but I'm going to ask you for your difference-making tip right now, buddy. What do you have for us?
Yeah, my difference making tip, I've been on this one for a while, is mentor somebody out there in the world. I think it's the most powerful thing we can do that's not related to our family or job, but find somebody who needs a mentor and help them out. Most good professionals that I know that have been successful tell me the same story. Oh, I got really lucky. I got a great mentor, right? Like, don't make the world about luck. Make it about purpose and be purposeful on that. Find somebody. Volunteer, raise your hand. There's lots of organizations out there looking for mentors all the time. Mentor, you probably have value you can give to somebody else and help guide them. And that's my main tip.
Well, I think that is great stuff. That definitely gets a come on. Jamie, thank you for coming back on the show. This is maybe your fifth time on that we're sharing a podcast together. Yeah. So thanks so much for coming back on.
Great to see you, my friend.
Yeah, for sure. Where can people learn more about you? How can they engage? Where can they get their copy of your retirement sketchbook?
Yeah, so a couple quick things. Easiest way to find me on social now is on LinkedIn. That's the one I'm pretty much active on. And if you type in Jamie Hopkins Financial Services, I will pop up very easily. My company website's bmt.com. FinServFoundation.org is the nonprofit that I spend the majority of my time with from a volunteer perspective. And then your retirement sketchbook is literally everywhere. I didn't even know it was going to be in Target. But it's going to be in Target. So one day you could probably just walk into Target, but it's available online. I think most people buy their stuff from Barnes & Noble or Amazon. So you can go on there and type it in and find a copy of the book. There is an audio book too. It's weird to do a drawing book and then have an audio book. So it's weird, but I tell most people don't buy an audio book for this, although the publisher was like, we need an audio book. So there is one.
Love yeah. it. Excellent. Well, if you enjoyed this as much as I did, show Jamie your appreciation. Share today's show with a friend who also appreciates good ideas. Get your copy of your retirement sketchbook wherever you buy your books, on Amazon or Barnes & Noble. I will link all those in the notes of the show. Find him on LinkedIn. Find him at bmt.com. And then the FinServe Foundation as well. And I will link all of those in the notes of the show. Thanks again, Jamie.
Appreciate it, George.
Finally, friendly reminder, there's never going to be anybody more interested in your financial success than you are. So act accordingly.